Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. With summer camps for pre-K through high school, offering skills in sports, music, and more. luther.edu/summer-camps.
Support for WPR comes from Wills on behalf of Wisconsin Public Libraries, offering access to ebooks, audiobooks, digital magazines, and more. Available with a Wisconsin Library Card at wisconsinsdigitallibrary.org.
From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
I stood still for a dog-sized thing we called a brown gun, which the Arieke termed koshish, or tifis. Depending on a taxonomic distinction we never understood.
That's an excerpt from the audiobook version of China Mieville's new novel, Embassy Town. The strange, simultaneous sounds in that clip represent the unique language of the alien beings that populate the novel. We'll meet Mieville in a moment as we explore the language of science fiction in this hour. Today, we'll also talk with pioneering author Samuel Delaney, who's been called the James Joyce of science fiction. Poet Amiri Baraka reflects on the cosmological music and poetry of Sun Ra. And So-Young Chu talks about her book, Do Metaphors Dream of Literal Sleep? A Science Fictional Theory of Representation. China Mieville doesn't follow trends. He sets them. His groundbreaking fiction has received critical acclaim and multiple awards. The Hugo Award, the British Science Fiction Award, twice, the Arthur C. Clarke Award, three times, and the World Fantasy Award. Mieville's new novel is called Embassy Town, and it will undoubtedly win him more awards. Among other accolades, Ursula Le Guin describes Embassy Town as a fully achieved work of art. Mieville told Anne Strangechamps that he came up with the original idea for the novel when he was 11 years old.
The initial peg for me was just the idea of aliens or creatures that speak with two voices simultaneously, and that was something that I did come up with when I was about 11. I'm not saying it's original, I'm not saying no one's done it before, but that was when I thought of it. It was original to me. I tend to be very faithful to my own sort of childish ideas, and I, you know, it sometimes takes me a long time for them to percolate through, but that one was sort of sitting there for a quarter of a century until it was eventually cooked and emerged.
Let's get the setting of Embassy Town down first. We're in the far future on a distant planet inhabited by these creatures who are hard to describe, so I'm not even going to try. Maybe you could have a go.
They're sort of deliberately not described conclusively in the book because the book is a first-person narrative written by someone from that world who doesn't feel the need to explain or to describe everything because it's just, you know, it's just where she lives. I recognize in myself very much a slightly kind of nerdy desire to kind of cross all the T's and dot all the I's and have everything explained in a very kind of exact sort of fashion. You know, sometimes I'm very happy to indulge that, but for this particular book, I wanted to do the opposite, and I wanted to not let myself do that, because although you gain something that way, you also lose something, because the focus of the book is not on the physical specificity of the aliens, and so I didn't want to kind of go down that route too far. So there are references made. We know that they're large. We know they have hooves. We know they have what are called wings, although they can't fly. We know that their cluster of eyes looks a little bit like a kind of coral outcrop, but the composite is left for the reader, I suppose. Mm.
So the Arieke also have two mouths, as you said. This is a biological difference that has profound implications for language and for communication. It's not just that their words are different, but their actual concept of language is completely different.
Yeah, there's two elements to the Ariakean language which are sort of distinct. One is, as you say, that they speak with two voices in harmony, and that was the original peg that we were talking about from when I was a really little kid. And then the second is a conceit about the philosophy of language, which is, you know, in very simple terms, they can't lie, but more specifically, that's because the way they relate the words and the concepts behind the words is fundamentally different. They don't signify in the same way humans signify. It's the sort of coalescing of those two facts that, you know, gives the language its its particularity from which the plot is kind of spun out, I suppose, really. It's kind of a symbolic cliche in English that, you know, someone who's, you know, speaking with a forked tongue, you know, two voices simultaneously is suggestive of lying and mendacity. And I liked the idea of just kind of inverting that in a very simple way, that there's this race that are literally dual-voiced and literally unable to lie. So it was that sort of little, very simple little sort of paradox that kind of spun it out.
Well, we should also try to get across a sense of just how playful the book is also. For instance, you even had to play with typography to figure out how to represent this language spoken with two mouths. So you come up with kind of the linguistic equivalent of a fraction.
It is literally a fraction. When I was writing the book initially and I was typing it, I kind of jerry-rigged something using a little kind of mathematical plug-in for a word processing software, which allows you to do like a kind of denominator and numerator. So you have one line of words above the other line of words. But again, this was, you know, when I was 11 and I was first writing about these, I was scribbling these two different lines of text with a line in between. I have tremendous fidelity to my own obsessions.
Well, I was thinking this is radio, so we can actually play with sound a little bit. We don't have two mouths. I thought we could try. So if you say two halves of an R-E-A-K word, the numerator and the denominator, so to speak, then we'll put them together.
Okay, you're on. Well, so for example, one of the Ariake characters in the novel is called by the humans Searle Tesh Esher. But in their own language, the Searle and the Tesh Esher would be spoken simultaneously.
Searle Tesh Esher.
And this is the effect that they've done with the audiobook. And it's really wonderful for me to hear because I'd been writing all this for a long time and I'd never actually heard what these things sounded like. And so it was quite thrilling for me to actually hear that.
Before the humans came, we didn't speak so much of certain things. Tesh Esher said again and shucked its wings.
So you can begin to understand why the humans who visit this planet have a hard time communicating with the Ariake. You'd almost need four ears to be able to hear them properly. But there's one woman, your protagonist, Avis, is that how you say her name?
Yeah, Avis Benecho.
Okay, your protagonist, Avis, who comes to know them maybe as well as any human can, so much so that she becomes part of their language. How does that work?
If you've got this race that can only speak things that are literally true, but also have a kind of hazy awareness of things beyond the absolutely quotidian, and they want to express something which they have a kind of hazy sense of, but which they've not been able to express before, what they do is they construct similes. So they say, you know, this is like something else. But the referent for the simile has to have existed for them to be able to conceive of it and to talk about it. So in the case of Avis in the book, a group of these aliens decide that they want to construct a figure of speech to enable them to say, this is like the girl who ate what she was given in darkness. But because there was no such girl, this thought was very kind of hazy and unclear in their head, and they had to actually have Avis go into darkness and eat something and actually have that become a reality in the world before they were then able to say this situation or that situation is like the girl who ate in darkness. And because there's now actually an embedded reference, they're able to say it clearly and to make a kind of oblique argument of similarity between the two things. And so there are a few people in this world who have the dubious honor of becoming similes.
That scene, it's really kind of sinister early in the book when whatever happens to Avis that turns her into a simile happens. I was going to ask if you could read a little bit of that scene.
Sure. What occurred in that crumbling once dining room wasn't by any means the worst thing I've suffered, or the most painful, or the most disgusting. It was quite bearable. It was, however, the least comprehensible event that had or has ever happened to me. I was surprised by how much that upset me. For a long time, the hosts didn't pay attention to me, but performed precise mimes. They raised their gift wings. They stepped forward and back. I could smell their sweet smell. I was frightened. I'd been prepared. It was imperative for the sake of the simile that I act my part perfectly. They spoke. I understood only the very basics of what I heard, could pick out an occasional word. I listened for the overlapping whisper I'd been told meant she, and when I heard it, I came forward and did what they wanted. I know now to call what I did then disassociating. I watched it all, myself included. I was impatient for it to finish. I felt nothing growing, no special connection between me and the hosts. I was only watching. After I was done, in the youth mall, my friends demanded all details. We were roughnecks, like most Embassy Towner children are. You were with the hosts? That's import, Avi. You swear? Say it like a host? Say it like a host, I said, appropriately solemn for the oath. No way! What did they do? I showed my bruises. I both did and didn't want to talk about it. Eventually, I enjoyed the telling and embellishing of it. It gave me status for days.
That is such a scene. You've managed to make it both creepy and beautiful at the same time. And then also funny at the end.
I'm delighted you think so. It was a lot of fun to... Well, fun is not really the right word, but I'd had that notion of becoming embedded in language a long time, and I was quite careful about the writing of it.
It strikes me that you're working at the limits of thought and the limits of human perception, trying to kind of push past them. And yet there's something deeply paradoxical about this, isn't there? We use words to think, and you're trying to think your way outside of words, which is quite a challenge for a writer.
I think it's a challenge in which you cannot succeed. I think that this notion of pushing beyond is literally unachievable, and an Embassy Town is very much about that. There are quite explicit arguments and debates in Embassy Town between characters on precisely this issue of the notion of the limits of words and the limits of language and so on. You know, one of the great pleasures about writing fiction and reading fiction is not having to come down on one side or the other of these kind of situations. If I were writing a non-fiction piece, I would feel like I had to kind of have some kind of conclusion, some kind of systematic kind of pulling together of the various strands. In fiction, you know, I have the luxury of being able to indulge my kind of intense desire to represent the unrepresentable while knowing full well that's impossible. What you end up hoping is that the process of attempt creates its own kind of thing. It is engaging and is exciting and is powerful. You know, the power of a book doesn't necessarily rest in its success or otherwise at its stated task. The process can be part of the point. And I will say for myself, I don't mind as a reader doing a little bit of work. You don't necessarily want it all the time, but I don't mind books where I don't understand what's going on for some section of the book. As long as I feel like I'm in sort of reasonably safe hands, I feel like the writer is not kind of maliciously playing games with me. If that sense of not understanding is part of the affect that I think is powerful about the book, I'm quite happy to surrender to that. So in and of itself, the criticism which is sometimes leveled against my books, or indeed various other books, I didn't understand what was going on for X number of pages. In and of itself, that to me is not a criticism. You know, now I understand that's not the case for a lot of readers. I understand some readers really find that very frustrating, and fair enough, completely understood, they have every right to read what they want to read. Maybe Embassy Town wouldn't appeal to them. But speaking for myself as a reader, I get an immense pleasure out of reading a book where for the first 30 or 40 pages or even more, I really don't understand what's happening, but I feel completely compelled anyway, and I feel like the writer is pulling me through.
Chana Mieville is the author of Embassy Town. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps. Mieville said he doesn't mind reading novels where he doesn't always understand what's going on. Do you feel the same way? Or do you get frustrated and abandon the book? You can share your thoughts by sending us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Always nice to hear from you. Coming up, we'll meet the pioneering science fiction writer Samuel Delaney as we continue our Hour on the Language of Science Fiction. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
Samuel R. Delaney's been described as American science fiction's most consistently brilliant and inventive writer.
Delaney didn't waste any time launching his science fiction writing career. He was a published author before he turned 20. In the decade since 1962, Delaney's published many novels and short stories. He's won 4 Nebula Awards and 2 Hugo Awards. In 2002, he was inducted into the Science Fiction Hall of Fame. Delaney's nonfiction includes the essay collection The Jewel-Hinged Jaw, Notes on the Language of Science Fiction. Delaney is a sentence lover, as he tells Steve Paulson.
The sentence, because it's made up of a string of words, that string is flexible. You can do things with the sentence, and the sentence can signal more things than individual words can. Back in the 1890s, Mallarmé said very famously that poetry was made of words, and for many people at the time, this was a revelation, because people during the Victorian era, and even up into the Edwardian, had tended to think of poetry as made out of sentiments, and that somehow the language was a transparent wall between sentiments and expression. And of course, it's not. It's the mediating material that actually makes a poem a poem, makes a piece of prose rather than a poem, and makes it either a good poem or a good piece of prose, or a poor poem or a poor piece of prose. Single words don't do this. Groups of words do. Groups of words form clichés. Groups of words are original. That's why you need a full sentence at the minimum to express yourself with any kind of fluency.
So I'm wondering how this plays out then when you write science fiction, whether there's sort of the particular way that sentences are constructed. And in fact, you've talked about science fiction as a play of codic conventions.
Well, the point is the various genres are distinguished by the kinds of sentence conventions that they appeal to. Prose puts the words together in one particular form. Poetry puts the words together in another form. When the words are put together in poetic form, you listen to them differently. You pay attention to them differently. When they're put together in a prosaic form, again, you pay a different kind of attention to them. And it's the same sort of thing with science fiction. The kinds of examples that I frequently use are things like, "Then her world exploded." If you say that in a piece of naturalistic fiction, it's a metaphor for the emotional state of one of the female characters. However, if you say that in a piece of science fiction, you have to retain the possibility that it might actually mean that a planet belonging to a woman blew up. And because there are the alternate meanings in science fiction that are allowed in, there are different kinds of things that you can say. When you start looking at a whole range of specifically science fictional phrases with specifically science fictional interpretations to them, what you find is that in science fiction, again and again, collections of words that are metaphoric in naturalistic fiction are taken literally when they occur in science fiction, and it produces a different range of possible meanings.
Now, I'm going to ask a little bit about your background. From what I've read, you were a prodigy from early on. You were a voracious reader.
That $2.50 gets you right on the bus.
I want to ask about something else that I've read about is apparently when you were quite young, you went off to see a lot of tutors and psychologists because your spelling was really bad and your handwriting was bad.
I think much more to the point, rather than being a prodigy, I was also severely dyslexic. And so I had some, you know, severe learning. On the one hand, I tested off the chart, you know, as far as IQ was concerned. But by the same token, I couldn't spell the word paper 3 times correctly in a row. So I had to do a lot of extra work on my spelling and my writing.
Had you been diagnosed as dyslexic from early on, or did that only come
later? Well, no, as a matter of fact, they didn't diagnose anybody as dyslexic back then. People weren't even sure that dyslexia actually existed. When I was a child, I read voraciously, and I read everything you got within, you know, 20 feet of me. I would read it. Then I'd sit down and try to write something, and it would be practically illiterate. And they were pretty sure initially that this was attention-getting behavior of some sort, and it wasn't. It was a perfectly honest learning disability. It was not until I was about 21 when they began to realize, no, there really is something that they can call dyslexia, and I had it.
Did that make a big difference to you once you had that understanding?
Oh, yes, it did. Yes, it did. It did. Because, I mean, for instance, I never knew whether it was attention-getting behavior, and I just didn't understand it myself. I mean, it was a very confusing thing to have.
So given your difficulty of, you know, putting words to paper, to actually spelling things, I'm wondering if that affected your development as a writer, if it sort of changed your way of writing.
Obviously, I think it does. For one thing, you get into the habit of rewriting things, because in order to do what the lexic do so cavalierly, you have to rewrite everything you write, every paper or a piece of writing that you write. You have to rewrite it 5 times, you know, just to get what people call the basic mechanics correct. That's what you have to do. You rewrite a lot.
You were the first major African-American science fiction writer, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In language, I mean, we've been talking about language was paramount to sort of the way you thought about your writing. Do you think you brought something new to the table there that really didn't exist in science fiction at the time?
I read a lot, not only in science fiction, but I also read a lot of literature, and I think I was perhaps willing to play with all sorts of rhetorical approaches to storytelling that not only were associated with, dare I say, hack writing, but also with literary writing. And I tried to use them all. The results, I hope, were slightly more interesting stories that were told in a slightly more interesting way.
Now, we've been talking about how you were really a pioneer in various ways. I mean, your use of language, the fact that you were this African-American writer in a genre that, you know, where there really weren't black writers at the time. You've also identified yourself as gay.
That's right, yes.
For a long time, I mean, since you were an adolescent, how does sexuality inform your work?
A great deal, from one end to the other. very much so, yeah.
Have you found that the genre that you've often written in science fiction, was that an especially good genre to explore questions about sexuality, especially for a gay man? I mean, someone who sort of was writing about things that perhaps early on were really not out there yet in mainstream culture?
It's interesting that the stories that first won awards, I and Gomorrah, and then Time Considered as a Helix of Semi-Precious Stones, they're the two stories that I happen to write that have something to do with matters gay. It's as almost as though the Science Fiction Writers of America, which is not a particularly gay organization, nor at that time was it particularly gay-friendly. If anything, you would have thought it was actually downright homophobic. If you look at some of the articles that appeared in their regular newsletter, but it nevertheless, it seemed like that somehow the constituency of the organization was almost hungry for this kind of story, so that when these two stories came out, you know, more than a year apart, although there were other stories that I had written too, these are the stories that seem to suddenly attract all the attention, and the ones that walked off with the awards.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know some science fiction writers kind of reject being categorized in that particular genre as if it ghettoizes them, and I guess I'm wondering if it's still useful to talk about the science fiction genre and, you know, to make distinctions between that and just fiction in general.
Well, I think the ghetto is something of a frame of mind. I can remember maybe 10 or 15 years ago walking into a bookstore that I went into fairly frequently, and there was a young woman who had a cart of books that she was shelving the books. And one of the books that was on the top of her cart was Don DeLillo's Ratner's Star, a novel that's about the government supporting some mathematicians who are trying to decipher some signals coming in from a far star. It's a fun read for a science fiction reader. And I said to her, you know, that's a really interesting novel. You should put a few copies up the stairs in the science fiction section. And she looked at me and she said, oh, no, this is a very good novel. And I said, yes, I know, I've read it. That's why I was suggesting you put it upstairs in the sign. And she said, no, that's crazy, and turned away. So I turned away and figured, well, I'll let that one go. And then I turned around, and the tears were running down her face. I mean, she was actually crying. She was so upset that someone had suggested that this novel by Don DeLillo, of all people, be considered science fiction, that she was in tears. And you realize that people have a huge emotional investment in keeping the genres separate. It's emotional. It's real. They will cry if you suggest that you break these barriers down.
Well, I'm wondering if we could finish off by actually having you read something from one of your novels. And I was thinking of the beginning of your 1984 novel, Stars in My Pocket Like Grains of Sand, which I think has just been recently reissued.
So this is the opening of the prologue. Of course, they told him in all honesty, you will be a slave. His big, poured forehead wrinkled. His heavy lips opened. The flesh around his green, green eyes stayed exactly the same. The ideogram of incomprehension, among whose radicals you could read ignorance's determinant past, information's present impossibility, speculation's denied future. But you will be happy. The man in the wire filament mask went on from the well in the circle desk. Certainly you will be happier than you are. The features moved behind pink and green plastic lozenges, a shake on shaking wires. I mean, look at you, boy. You're ugly as mud and tall enough to scare children in the street. The prenatal brain damage, small as it is, we still can't correct. You've been in trouble of one sort or another for as long as there are records on you. Orphanages, foster homes, youth rehabilitation camps, adult detention units, and you haven't gotten along in any of them. Sexually? Lozenge tinkled against lozenge. The man's head shook. In this part of the world, your preferences in that area can't have done you any good. You're a burden to yourself, to your city, to your geosector. Lozenges lowered just a bit. The man moved forward in his seat. But we can change all that. He pushed back in the sling that was uncomfortable and costly. A blank and intricate absence on his face, he raised one big knuckled hand to point with a finger thick as a broom handle, for the technology of that world still made lathes, lasers, bombs, and brooms. The nail was gnawed almost off it, as were the nails on his other fingers and thumbs, crowding his wide palm's edge, whether flailing before him or loose in his lap. Those fingers seemed not only too rough and too heavy for any gentle gesture, but also, though, if you counted, there were only 10, too many. The finger, not the four, but the middle, jabbed brutally, futilely. You can change me? The voice in his 19-year-old throat was harsh as some 50-year-old derelict's. You can make me like you? Go on. Make me so I can understand things and numbers and reading and stuff. As brutally the finger came back against the horsebone jaw, a mutated herpes virus, along with some sex-linked genetic anomaly, had, until 3 years ago when the proper phage was developed, rendered the ordinary adolescent acne in the urban males of that world's lower latitude a red pitted disaster. All right, change me. Make me like you.
Samuel R. Delaney reading from his 1984 novel Stars in My Pocket Like Grains of Sand. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Delaney's new novel is called Through the Valley of the Nest of Spiders. Have you read any of Samuel Delaney's fiction? If so, what did you think of it? You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, do metaphors dream of literal sleep? Also, put on your space helmet, because we're going to explore the way-out, metaphysical, interplanetary weirdness of Sun Ra's music and poetry as we conclude our hour on the language of science fiction. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. So-young Chu teaches English at Queens College, City University of New York. She's also the author of Do Metaphors Dream of Literal Sleep? A Science Fictional Theory of Representation. Most of us think of science fiction as a genre that imagines places and things which don't really exist. But in her book, Chu argues that science fiction actually does refer to reality, that it's a kind of high-intensity realism. She uses such examples as war trauma, cyberspace in the 1990s, and robot rights to bolster her argument.
The globalized world, that's another example of a cognitively estranging referent that we often approach metaphorically. Spaceship Earth, global village, time-space compression. When we use such figures of speech, we don't actually mean that planet Earth is a spaceship. But in science fiction, we find such metaphors powerfully and really effectively literalized in ways that make globalization available for narrative experience to the reader or to the watcher if it's a film.
You also explore the subject of post-memory Han in your book. What is post-memory Han?
To explain post-memory Han, I should probably explain each term individually. Post-memory, the term post-memory, was coined by Marianne Hirsch in her book Family Frames, where she notes that children of Holocaust survivors often, quote-unquote, remember a tragedy that they didn't experience firsthand. So Hirsch uses this powerful term, post-memory, to designate this form of intergenerational memory, whereby the experience remembered is both literal and figurative. It's real and yet virtual. It's intimately familiar and yet obviously secondhand. It's present tense. It feels current, and yet it is objectively something that happened long ago.
And maybe even to someone else.
Right. And I actually found myself thinking about this concept of post-memory in connection to Korean-American writers who write about remembering what their parents or grandparents went through during the Korean War, during the Japanese occupation. So I suppose post-memory Han could be defined as the Korean-American form of post-memory. Hmm. Han, by the way, is a word with no equivalent in English. It refers to a Korean form of grief.
You talk about some of the Korean texts, some of the Korean fiction that's been written. Is any of this science fiction?
Absolutely. For example, in Teresa Hawking Cha's autobiography, Dictée, Cha invokes post-memory Han by figuring herself as this bionic telepath who recalls distant events such as her mother's near-death experience while exiled in Manchuria, with photographic exactness. And in this collection of poems by Suji Kwok Kim, it's called Notes from the Divided Country, Kim renders post-memory Han, this cognitively estranging referent, available for representation by describing it science fictionally as a genetic condition that's, you know, made of chromosomes. Her parents' Han-filled memories permeated her own body while she was inside her mother's womb. And thus, in Kim's science fictional account of post-memory Han, the Japanese occupation, the Korean War, neither of which she experienced firsthand, have become part of her DNA. Obviously, that's not literally true, but in this science fictional poetry, the reader gets this rich, sensuous, vivid sense of the ways in which events that weren't experienced by the lyric speaker can still seem to be so much a part of the speaker's body. It's as though these events have inscribed themselves into her DNA.
You wrote about one of her poems called Generation. And in fact, you quote a couple of stanzas from it. Would you mind reading a little bit of it for us?
Oh, not at all. This is a stanza in which Sujikwak Kim uses this really lush organic imagery to describe her experiences as an embryo growing in her mother's body. I entered the labyrinth of mother's body. I wandered through nerve forests, branching in every direction, towering trees fired by feeling, crackling and smoldering. I rode through vein rivers. I splashed in lymph creeks between islands of glands. I leapt rib to rib, rung to rung on the spine. I swung from the ropes of entrails. I played on organs, leapt through a fog of sweet oxygen in the lungs. I clambered over tectonic plates of the skull, scrambling not to fall down the chasms between the mind mountains where I could see no bottom. I peered through sockets at the brain brewing in cliffs of bone, like a gigantic volcano with its magma of memories, magma of tomorrows. I could have played there forever, watching, wondering at the vast expanses inside, wondering at the great chambers of the heart.
You know, I never thought of poetry as science fiction or using the two forms together, but they really belong together, don't they? That is science fiction.
Oh, absolutely. And not just because the lyric speaker here is invoking science fictional imagery, such as, you know, a magma of tomorrows. I mean, one of the arguments that I make in the introduction, well, actually throughout the book, is that science fiction and lyric poetry are intimately interconnected. That's probably the most counterintuitive claim that I make in this book.
Well, actually, there's another poem that people may know and have no association with science fiction. You quote an Emily Dickinson poem.
Yes,
in the book.
I do.
And in fact, would you read a little bit of that? I Felt a Funeral.
Absolutely.
In My Brain? That would be great.
I'd love to read the entire poem if that's...
Oh, please, go ahead.
Okay. I felt a funeral in my brain and mourners to and fro. Kept treading, treading, till it seemed that sense was breaking through. And when they all were seated, a service like a drum kept beating, beating, till I thought my mind was going numb. And then I heard them lift a box and creak across my soul with those same boots of lead again. Then space began to toll, as all the heavens were a bell and being but an ear. And I and silence, some strange race, wrecked, solitary, here. And then a plank in reason broke, and I dropped down and down, and hit a world at every plunge, and finished knowing then.
You know, you don't have to call it science fiction to enjoy it, but it is science fiction, isn't it?
It is. The voice here is to me, it's a post-apocalyptic voice. It's otherworldly. It's speaking from some dimension beyond human time. The lyric speaker, she's speaking from a place that one might even describe as alien. She's no longer a part of the human race. Instead, she and silence constitute some strange race, wrecked, solitary here, stranded in some kind of void. I've always thought of this poem as science fictional. I mean, I remember vividly the first time I read this poem.
Yeah, I wonder, thinking about Emily Dickinson, whether the term science fiction had any existence at the time she wrote it, and I guess whether or not it did, what she would think of your use of it in relation to her poem.
Oh, gosh.
She'd probably be pleased.
I would love to have a conversation with her. about science fiction. You know, it's interesting. There's a growing subgenre, it seems to me, of science fiction novels and short stories in which Emily Dickinson is a science fictional character. In one story, for example, she's abducted by aliens and then she returns to Earth. Her head is filled with poetry, with otherworldly poetry. And then she writes all of her poems in the aftermath of that alien experience. Hmm. I think maybe the reason for this growing subgenre is there's something so otherworldly about her voice.
Soyoung Chu is the author of Do Metaphors Dream of Literal Sleep, a science fictional theory of representation. Amiri Baraka is a celebrated poet, playwright, and activist. He's also written the foreword to the book This Planet is Doomed, the science fiction poetry of Sun Ra. The book is a collection of poems by Sun Ra, the innovative bandleader and composer known for his eclectic music and his crazy costumes that included space helmets. Amiri Baraka spoke to Steve Paulson about Sun Ra.
Now, see, Sun Ra actually believed that what he was talking about and who he was as a musician was beyond what was the given, the common, that it was beyond the commercial, and that he was actually speaking a philosophy that was more than just musical philosophy. Read this book called This Planet is Doomed, that the whole book of poetry there speaks of needing another world, needing another mind, needing another human being, and another language, and all those things. At base, Sun Ra saw himself as a kind of a cosmic reformer, you know, that he had come to help reform the Earth, the planet Earth, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he had this whole story. I mean, part of his personal mythology that he was of the angel race and he was from Saturn. what do you make of that?
There was this German guy that asked him, you know, he was interviewing him. He said, come on, Sun Ra, now tell the truth. You've never been to Saturn. Sun Ra said, yeah, you're right. He said, but I have been to Jupiter. He wasn't going for any kind of literal interpretation of what he was saying. Everything that he says, even those things that sound way out, are really kind of explained in a kind of evolutional science. When he talks about we travel the space waves from planet to planet, there's no kind of law that says we will not immigrate to another planet. I mean, they already got all these space probes and spaceships. They've been trying to get to Mars for hundreds of years and so forth and so on. So what he was saying in that regard was pretty, you know, scientifically possible.
Take me back to the 60s then, when Sun Ra had landed in New York. There he was with his orchestra, what he called his orchestra. What was he doing that no one else was doing back then?
Well, Sun Ra was making a kind of free jazz. He was not just adhering to the kind of Tin Pan Alley legacy that most of the music has, and even the beboppers who were just using the harmonies rather than those same kind of melodies was still linked to those kind of chord structures. What Ra said, and indeed all those musicians that came out during that time, Ornette Coleman, Albert Isla, Pharoah Sanders, all those musicians, beginning with the late Coltrane, began to emphasize going beyond the kind of Tin Pan Alley structures. And it just seemed like Sun Ra was just doing it in earnest. He was trying to go as far as he could. But the music has very clear African, Asian, Latin kind of basis to what it is, although he'll go off and play some sounds perhaps you never heard or never heard associated with jazz, although if you have listened to most modern world music, you'll certainly hear that if you listen to Webern or Stravinsky or somebody like that, or Bartok. What Ra was doing was trying to make a kind of cosmopolitan music past just the regular kind of nightclub bebop.
Let me ask you about the title poem from this collection of Sun Ra's poetry called This Planet Is Doomed.
This planet is doomed.
There's a lot of anger in that poem, and it makes very effective use of the Sun Ra persona in terms of comparing the African-American's place in society to that of a space alien from another planet. What do you make of that poem?
Well, see, I think that, see, Sun Ra, his own personal life was like that. In a particular microcosm, Sun Ra was not everybody's Negro walking around. You know what I'm saying? He had a concept of himself not only as a specific isolated creator in a society of mediocrities, which is what he would describe it, but then he could parallel that to the life of the Afro-American, just a regular Afro-American walking around who was like isolated from the great American dream, you know, and then particularly the Afro-American artists who had to find venues, had to find an audience for what he considered to be way out for things that were exceptional.
It just breaks me all up, man. It just breaks me all up. I just can't understand it. Can't understand a damn bit of it. Like, man, I gotta get away from him. I gotta get away from him before they mess up my mind. Before they take my soul, man, I just gotta get away and blast off in my rocket ship. I come from a better place than this. Why in the hell am I here for? I'm here to keep up with the pricks. And all the narrow-minded hoodlums. All the big talkers and big money makers and rackets. And all these pricking squares around. Hell no. I gotta blast away. I gotta get away, man. I gotta blast off like a super Megatron rocket on electrodynamic radiation. Ch-ch-ch. Can't stand it, man. I gotta get away.
Now, Sun Ra is known mainly for his music, not his poetry.
Yeah.
Do you see the two as kind of going hand in hand, or were they two very different things?
No. The poetry was used during the music. If you ever heard a concert of Sun Ra's music, he would sometimes repeat some of these poems while the music was playing. He had these space goddesses, Verda Mae Grosvenor, June Tyson, who might walk around the room reciting this poem, or sometimes a whole line of musicians with the space goddesses in it would walk around reciting this poem.
Is the soul, whether or a nation, a people, a government, or an individual, whether real or artificial, schools can develop soul.
Do you have a favorite Sun Ra poem yourself?
Let me see. Like a universe, perfect, if they only knew what great jokes God has played on humanity. Yes, he's placed me in the midst of them for vague purpose of vague, and yet so great that I don't know where it is myself. I don't know where this purpose lies, hidden. What is there? A soft fire that is burning within me to let me know, yes, it's there. And my mind searches for it, my heart searches for it, and I look and I think, yes, here it is. Then it's gone. It's like a mist. Then it's like a sunset. It's like a sunrise. It's like a universe. It lies there, and yet I walk among people all along, not knowing, and the people not knowing. And then I think, I say, what a great joke I am. And then, strangely enough, I look at people sometimes and I hate them. I look at them and I hate them. I don't wish to destroy them. I don't want to harm them, but I hate them because I know that I'm part of them, that I'm here for them, that I belong to them, and that's why I hate them. Because, you see, if I didn't belong to them, if I wasn't placed here for them, I would be a free spirit. But I can't be free as long as I haven't served my purpose. I can't be free as long as I give to people what I have to give to them. Yes, I'm more free than most men. I'm more free than most spirits, but yet I'm chained. You see, it's a great joke on me, too. Then again, I look at people and I love them. I love them so very much until I turn my head in shame. I want to touch them with my fingertips and erase the frown from their face. I want to touch them with my mind and erase every care and every sorrow away. I want to touch them with my mind and open their mind's eye to let them see the things that I know and feel. I want to do that because I love them. Then I look at them, then I hate them again. I hate hate them because I love them so much, and I don't know. I don't know where the hate begins and the love ends. I don't know how love ends and hate begins. I don't know any of these things. All I know is I'm a great joke. I'm the biggest joke that's ever been played upon the world, and people think, they think that God has no ailment, but I know because I'm a living joke. I'm one that will cause people to scratch their heads in wonderment in search of their hollow hearts and look in their souls and wonder, where did he come from? What is he? Who made him? You see, I'm such a great joke until I tickle myself.
Now, I'm curious, how has Sun Ra's poetry and music influenced your own creative work, if it has?
Well, Sun Ra certainly came in a period where I think our generation was thinking similar kinds of thoughts, whether it was Albert Eiler or later Train or Ornette Coleman. We had similar kinds of ideas. First of all, transcending American society. And I thought that there's a commonality in that, so that even the science fiction aspect of it was related to the fact that we wanted this society to change and were willing even to posit alternative models. I mean, Sun Ra speaks consistently of alter worlds, alter life. Things that are not this way are parallel, but different, you know.
And I suppose that's where the whole science fiction legacy comes in as well. I mean, as you know, absolutely. Why someone who identifies with that science fiction tradition is a radical. I mean, you're imagining newer and possibly better worlds.
Absolutely. Well, even in something like Bradbury, The Martian Chronicles, if you read that, you know, and I read that so long ago, man, when I was in high school, you see that constantly in those stories. There's one called, what's that story? Way in the Middle of the Air, about these people come in the South looking for these black people, and the black people are all getting on a rocket ship, leaving the Earth. That is progressive in that sense, that number one, if American society depends on them so much that they have to go look for them, and that they're so suppressed or oppressed, on the other hand, that they want to get out of here, it really expresses a commonality. When's that, 1950-something, or late 40s, early 50s? But a lot of those stories, even in somebody like Bradbury, are progressive vis-a-vis American life and fiction, you know.
It must not be forgotten that music is a language all its own. A language whose foundation and projection is in melody, rhythm, and harmony. The extension and consideration of music in an advanced form as to composition, sculpture, shape and form, arrangement, length, depth and width, message, meaning, impression, strength, degree, beauty, badness, all dimensions of being. Every place there is music.
That's Sun Ra reciting from his poem, The Outer Darkness. The other readings were by Sun Ra's collaborators. Three albums of Sun Ra's poetry have recently been reissued. Amiri Baraka wrote the foreword to This Planet is Doomed, the science fiction poetry of Sun Ra. He spoke with Steve Paulson. You can find more links to information about the book and the CDs on our website, ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 925A, The Language of Science Fiction. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Special thanks to special guest engineer Brittany DeAnda. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.